Our first thought in thinking about material in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 is to say, well, it's all about the contribution and it's all about laying aside for the needy saints in Jerusalem. And that is the specific thing that Paul is talking about in these chapters. But I want us to understand that there are wonderful and, you know, even profound principles that are laid down in these chapters for all of our service as Christians. And as Paul is using this letter to defend his apostleship, he is talking about how that you can distinguish between genuine service to God and that which is not authentic or real service to God. He's making a distinction between his service, the service of the other apostles and their co-workers, versus the false teachers. This makes this letter more meaningful to us, or it should make it more meaningful to us, because all of us are trying to serve God in an acceptable manner. It is our desire to always be pleasing to Him, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9. The principles that we find in chapters 8 and 9, we will see, go far beyond just the matter of giving into a collection. That's part of the reason why that I had a lesson last Sunday night, is I knew that I wasn't going to be able to cover all of the various things that one might say about the collection. And I thought, I'll introduce some things in that lesson that have to do with what authority do we find? What does that authority apply to in regard to the collection? Went back to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Tried to talk a little bit about the importance of our stewardship in those funds that are collected, the right of a congregation to have a treasury, and then the oversight and proper use of those funds. And that's the reason why that I had that lesson, is because I thought, there's so much here, how am I going to get around to talking about all these things? I can't. But we noticed last week, as we were closing in chapter 7 and verse 16, that Paul says to the brethren, therefore I rejoice that I have confidence in you in everything. This is a wonderful statement by which to get into the matter of their giving for the needy saints, that he expresses his great confidence in them. Paul had talked about how that they had gone beyond what anyone might have supposed or expected in regard to accepting the admonitions given by Titus. When he spoke to them, he says in verse 11 of the text, observe this very thing, that you sorrowed in a godly manner, what diligence it produced in you, what clearing of yourselves, what indignation, what fear, what vehement desire, what zeal, what vindication, in all things you proved yourselves to be clear in this matter. There is a high point that we see in chapter 7 as he is writing to these brethren. He is expressing great confidence in them. He praises them for what they have done in regard to correcting the situation with the man, the sinful man, from chapter 2. And so this is a fitting place then for him to begin. But not only were the Corinthians worthy of praise and commendation, not condemnation, commendation, but there are other Christians that were worthy of commendation. And this is how he begins in chapter 8 then. And because I want us all to have this in our mind, please allow me to quickly read through this text so that we all see the setting that we're talking about here. In chapter 8, moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. And so we urge Titus that as he had begun, so he would also complete this grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in all diligence, and in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. I speak not by commandment, but I am testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. And in this I give advice. It is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you also must complete the doing of it. That as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion out of what you have. For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, that their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be an equality. As it is written, he who gathereth much hath nothing left over, and he who gathereth little hath no lack. But thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus. For he not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord. And we have sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. And not only that, but who was also chosen by the churches to travel with us with this gift, which is administered by us to the glory of the Lord himself and to show your ready mind. Avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift, which is administered by us, providing honorable things, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. And we have sent with them our brother, whom we have often proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent because of the great confidence which we have in you. If anyone inquires about Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker concerning you. Or if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Therefore, show to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. As we look at this, I want us to notice some questions. Evidently, my trying to bring them up one at a time, I must have done something wrong. But so what example does he begin with here in trying to stir up the brethren? And that's what he's trying to do. He holds up an example. He's trying to stir them up. And who is the example of course? The Macedonians and what they had done. What was so remarkable about what they had done? Okay. They had done this despite their own poverty. Despite the fact that as one would look at their situation, one would have said, you don't have a lot yourself. Do you know of any evidence in any other letter that might be a reference to this kind of poverty by any chance? In the book of Philippians, does it not seem as you come to chapter 4 that there was a concern on the part of the brethren there about what they had? That they were anxious about things, we're told, in that place? I don't know exactly what the circumstances were. He doesn't identify the specific churches. He just says the Macedonians. And it may have been something that was generally true of several congregations in Macedonia. It may have been the situation with the Thessalonians or with the Bereans. We don't know exactly. We're not told by the Apostle Paul. He simply says the Macedonians. But they gave, we are told, despite their own poverty. There's a lot that you could say about how remarkable their giving was. They insisted, we might say, on giving. It wasn't simply a matter of duty that Paul says to them, there are needy saints, you ought to be involved, this is a good work, put together some kind of contribution. They wanted to be involved, is what we talked about a little bit at the end of our lesson last Sunday night. They really strongly insisted that they have a chance to be involved. And so Paul talks about that. But what other example does Paul use in this text here to stir them up? Not only the Macedonians, and their giving was wonderful in every way. They gave themselves first to the Lord. He was a key to how they were able to give as generously, as abundantly as they did. They gave themselves first to the Lord, and Paul says, and then to us. Don't want to get off on a tangent, but that seems to be connected by the confidence the Macedonians had in Paul and his co-workers as being true servants of God. There were those that had come to Corinth questioning the apostleship of Paul, questioning whether Paul and these other men were really true servants of God. Evidently, the Macedonians did not have those doubts. They gave themselves first to the Lord and then to Paul and his co-workers in this matter. But what other example is given then here to stir them up? Christ. Christ is given. And would that example be more meaningful than even the Macedonians? Should it have been more meaningful than the Macedonians? Yeah, everybody's shaking their head yes. Of course it should have been. The Corinthians, if they had seen themselves properly in the right spiritual light, where they had been spiritually, how that they were sinners, how that they were those that needed the gospel of reconciliation, as we've talked about in former lessons, there should have been a deep humility that they felt, recognizing what God had done in their behalf, what Jesus had done in their behalf. He was rich, but he became poor. Philippians 2 talks about how that we should have the mind of Christ, the same spirit that Christ had, how that he emptied himself, how that he took upon himself the form of a man. He did that for us. He did that in our behalf. And Paul holds up that example. He says, as though he were asking them, what are you being asked to do that God himself hasn't done in your behalf? And so here is the example that he holds up to them in verse 9 of the text. As you go on here, he says, so what does he say it's important now for them to do then in this matter? Huh? Yes. Continue. Another word you might want to use there, complete it. Complete it. Finish it. This is what you had planned to do. When had they planned to do it? A year earlier. And we're not trying to press whether that could mean the way that they might have looked at time 9 months earlier or, 13 months earlier. But he says a year earlier. You had determined that you wanted to be involved in this, that you were going to give a contribution. Andy?
Do you think out of this that they may have been the first ones to make this decision and the other ones did it afterwards?
Well, of course, when he gave the instructions in 1 Corinthians 16, who does he say that he had already given instructions to? Churches of Galatia had already received. So they were not the very first ones. Now, whether or not they had somehow received this request before the Macedonians, I don't know that there's any way for us to know that.
Yeah, that's what I said. Well, this may be just reading the Latin first to make a beginning a year ago.
Okay, well, that may be. And I don't know, Andy, I can't speak to the Greek text there. I don't study the Greek text when I'm preparing for a class and note certain words and what significance they might have. It may be that that is intended. I don't know. Any other comments here? I ask you, brethren, is this sometimes a problem for people in their lives in general to finish things that they intend to do, that they, make plans to do? I see some people smiling. Don't ask my wife whether or not I have that problem. Whether or not I always finish or complete what I say that I'm going to do. And what I really mean to do, I really in my mind, yes, I intend to do that. Bob? Right. And, in the earliest part of the book, there had been these teachers that had come there and they had said, well, Paul had made plans to come visit you. His plan was to visit you twice. He was going to come, then he was going to go up to Macedonia, then he was going to come back down. He was going to visit twice. And he's changed his mind. And you can't count on him, is what they were implying. And that is true, isn't it? Is that we lack confidence in people that don't follow through, who say they're going to do something and then they don't do what they tell us that they're going to do. And that can affect the influence of people, not only within the community of God's people, it can affect their influence even with those that are in the world. And so we need to be careful that we don't make promises that we do not take seriously. There's a whole lot that's said by Jesus about making vows. The Old Testament talks about making vows and the danger of not fulfilling a vow, especially not fulfilling a vow to God. What is a vow, by the way? What's a vow? It's a promise. It's a promise that you're making. And, Jesus said that our yea should be yea and our nay should be nay. That when we say something to someone, it should be like, yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I intend. This is what I will do. And, if there's not really the kind of strong determination on your part that you are going to do what you say, then don't make those kind of commitments. Don't say those kind of things. It's Psalm 15, I think it's Psalm 15, that mentions who may dwell in God's abode. And one of the things that it mentions there, and I won't get the wording correct, I can't quote it, but is the idea is that those who have made a commitment, and then they'll keep the commitment, even if it means that there is almost a loss on their part, because they keep the commitment, they will keep the commitment. Our word is supposed to mean something. We should not be careless about what we say we're going to do. Promises that we make. Lesson?
They started it in front of the Lord, but they now have to do it. So they're like, well, it's more important. No, I'm having a plan to be sent out. I'm not going to do this much. But now they're like, well, are they going to help us?
Yeah.
No, it's about me.
Yeah. That's a really good observation. I hope that you recognize that in what Leslie was saying, that as he goes down in his discussion here in chapter 8, that he does follow this line of reasoning. It seems like he's touching on this reasoning that Leslie's referred to. And that is that there may have been those that were saying, well, I don't know that we have that much to give in comparison to what some could give. And Paul says to them in verse 13 and following, I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack. And this principle is carried on down into chapter 9 as well. The idea of God's ability to give us, I shouldn't say God's ability, because I'm going to repeat myself, but God will give to us what we need so that we can be involved in these good works. He will bless us. If we have the right kind of mind and spirit, He will help us so that we can be involved in this, in these good works. And so don't be trying to evaluate, well, what about others? What are they giving? And I don't know that I've got that much to give. I just think that that's a very good point here. Delaney? I'm sorry. Say that again, Delaney. Yeah. That God is able to make all grace abound towards you, that you may always, having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. Exactly. And that is one of those critical principles that I mentioned that doesn't just have to do with the laying by in store on the first day of the week. It is a principle. It is a principle that if you want to help somebody, you can find the time to do it. Yeah, I'm too busy. I don't have time. Well, guess what? God will help you to find time. God will help you to find time. Well, I'd like to teach them, but I don't have enough knowledge. I don't have enough understanding to even begin a study. Guess what? You look to God, and He will help you to find some things that you can say, some instruction that you can give. And maybe I'm, you know, stretching here, but I'm trying to say to us that if we really want to serve the Lord, God will help us. God will help us. Don't be looking for excuses. And I do think that part of what He is kind of has in the back of His mind is that you all may be thinking of excuses as to why you're not going to have this gift ready to the extent that you first promised.
Well, I think part of what might be getting at here, that is going down, is when you go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 16, He had told them that the whole purpose in that or at least part of the purpose in that was to show them, okay, apparently you made a great promise here. Here's how you can fulfill that without it being a great burden on yourself. You set aside a little each week.
Yeah.
You don't do it all at once where it is suddenly a burden.
Yeah.
And maybe part of what he's getting at here is that all of a sudden, really what for sure what he's getting at here is that he's sending Titus ahead to make sure, okay, everything's ready. Because of what you told me, I've been bragging on you.
Yeah.
I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want you to be embarrassed.
Yep.
So have you been doing what I told you to do based on your promise before so that this won't be a burden on you?
Yeah.
When you go to the analogy that you or the comparison that you're making, how much do we do that as far as the rest of our life?
Yeah.
If we're just expecting suddenly to be able to go teach somebody,
right,
that's not going to happen. We have to prepare for that.
Yes. Good point. Very good point. Very good point. I guess, you know, the people that are watching a little bit of news, there's only one news story, you know, that people are following in our country, obviously. And if our country had been thinking all along, you know, about how do we manage these things on the long-term basis, you know, maybe we wouldn't be struggling with certain things that we find right now. But that's a very good point. That, you know, if it's really your intent to want to be able to study with people and help people, you can't just think, okay, oh, I got a chance to study with somebody. But you haven't been preparing, you haven't been studying, you haven't been doing, you know. Good points, good thoughts that are being expressed here. So he's trying to urge them in regard to this matter. Any other comments? Did I miss somebody's hand? So he's trying to urge them, you know. And he says that what they're going to be judged on is what? What's the standard here? What's the measurement of whether or not they've given as God would want them to give? What's it based on? What they have. Not what you don't have. Not what you don't have. You can't give what you don't have to give. And again, you know, that's a principle that we find throughout the Scriptures. What does God expect of each individual in their life before Him? That we do according to our own individual or separate ability. Each one of us are accountable for what we ourselves can do. I'm not accountable for what you can do, and you're not accountable for what I can do. We're going to be judged on whether we've done what's in our capability. What is that statement? And I forgot now who it applies to. Where that the commendation is given, she has done what she could do. Was it the widow with the two mites? Is that what it was in Luke 21? I don't remember. But, you know, that's the principle. There's a principle there. There are lots of principles that are here. Okay. Going on. Let me see here. And I think that we've kind of covered what Paul's point is in chapter 8, verses 13 through 15, this idea. Who was coming to assist him in this? Who was kind of being put in charge of Titus? And Titus was there. He was the one that had encouraged them to respond in the proper way to Paul's urging them to correct matters. And while he was there, he had talked to them about the gift for the needy saints as well. And so Titus was coming back. But you notice something that it says about Titus. And here's an example, and this is in keeping with what the Macedonians had done. This is in keeping with what he's been trying to say about Christian service. Why did Titus do this? I mean, why was he willing to do this? Yeah. Verse 16. Thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus. Titus was glad to do this. You know, so often in life we're given things to do that we're not very excited about. And we do see them as a duty. And, you know, there's this, you know, responsibility that's kind of laid upon us. And that's not what we're reading about the service of Paul. That's not what we're reading about the Macedonians. That's not what we read about Titus. Is that they did these things because they wanted to. What would make somebody want to do something like this or want to serve God in any particular work? What has to be true? Why if Delan calls me up and says, "Honey, could you please stop by this place, and this place, and run these errands for me?" Why would I do that? Why would I say yes?
Well, your case goes above
us. Yeah.
And I think it's back to what he was talking about in the Macedonian book, that they first gave themselves to the Lord.
Yeah. You know, sure, honey. Sure, I'll do that. You don't think, oh, nuts, I'm not going to be able to go do what I want to do. I was going to stop by the driving range and hit a bucket of balls. I don't do that. But I'm just saying that if I was the kind of person that did that, you know, I was going to do this, I was going to do that. No, you say, yeah, sure, sure. Why? Because of your commitment to that person, because of your love of that person, because you're seeing, you know, yeah, I'll do that, don't worry about it. She says, no, I'm sorry, I forgot you were going to go hit a bucket of balls. I'll do it. No, don't, no, really. It's not a problem. I'll go by and I'll do it. I'll do it. And, but wonderful principles here of Christian service. Now, was Titus coming by himself? No, he's not coming by himself. How many people were coming with him? Well, at least two. At least two. And we don't know who these guys were. They're not named for us. We are told a little bit about them. Verse 18, here's the first one. We have sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. Now, guess what a whole lot of commentators want to spend a whole lot of time trying to do? Figure out who this person is. And I mean, you could find people commenting on 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and 20% of their comments on the chapter is, who are the two guys that are mentioned here, and all the reasons it could be this one, and probably isn't this one, and, you know, we don't know. All we know is that he was someone that obviously was well known. It talks about his praises in the gospel throughout all the churches. Not only that, he was chosen by the churches to travel with us with this gift. Remember, Paul had said in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, he said, whoever you choose to go with me and take your gift, that will be fine. And the same thing for all the other churches. Whoever they choose to be their messenger, you know, that'll be your choice. You decide. And it is very likely that several of the congregations may have said, well, we all know this guy, and he can be the messenger for all of us. And let him do that. So there's that individual that is referred to. And then in verse 22, he goes on and he says, and we have sent with him our brother, whom we've often proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent because of the great confidence which we have in you. So there's another brother that has been a co-worker in some sense with Paul or others that are known. And he says, so that Titus is coming, and there's at least two others that are with him. Now, what is part of the reason why that Paul sends them on ahead? Obviously, they're going to carry this letter. Titus is going to carry this letter. And there are matters that need to be dealt with that are in this letter. But what else is the reason that, and Tony's already alluded to this, but what else is the reason for them coming on ahead? Paul's not going to get there for a while. And I don't know that we can be very accurate in trying to know how much longer it will be. When he finally gets there, he'll spend 3 months there. But why did he send them on ahead so far as the gift is concerned? To make sure it's ready so that they wouldn't be embarrassed? When Paul came, when the other messengers came, that there wouldn't be, you know, oh, the Corinthians, they were ready. They said they were going to put together a gift. And now they come with Paul, and where's the gift? This is the gift? This is it? And so Paul urges them to have this ready. And really, we could say that this is a part of chapter 9. I apologize. I kind of jumped ahead there without us reading any of that. Any comments about that? Is this a principle, brethren, that we need to be concerned about what other brethren think of us? Now understand the way that I'm asking that question. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yes. That's exactly right. As he does refer to back in chapter 8, that the reason for arranging things so that these messengers are going with Paul is that all things can appear honorable with all men. There is going to be complete transparency. We like that word today, you know. We talk about, but that people can know, people can see. I was talking this past week to a brother that goes every year to Ethiopia, and when funds were sent for the needy saints there 2 or 3 years ago, the brethren were very, very careful that everything would be done in a very open and transparent way. There was great detail to how all of the monies were distributed. There was a lot of, duplicity. Maybe I'm not using that word. A lot of duplication. There was not just one person that was saying, here, this is how much money, but there is another person that is able to verify and witness and to see that is exactly what had happened and what had taken place. I mentioned last Sunday night that it was very troublesome to me to know of a situation where that the brethren were not being upfront and honest with the congregation, the elders were not being upfront and honest with the brethren about how much money that they had in the collection. They were not posting an accurate account of the money that was in the treasury. And that was because they had a discussion about monies that needed to be spent for some building improvement. And they didn't want the brethren to know where they were at. Now, brethren, there has got to be complete honesty and transparency and openness in all matters. But brethren, we get particularly skittish when people aren't honest with us about money. That's just our nature. That's just our nature. You know, somebody comes to our house and says, that, yeah, I'll fix that for $50. You know, and what do we say? Can I have that in writing? You know, can you give me that estimate in writing? You know, because we have found out that sometimes the original estimate is this is what it's going to cost. And then when the final, now your company doesn't do that. But when the final bill comes back, it isn't what was estimated. We're talking about a completely different set of figures that we're looking at. I think that's part of, dare I say it, that our country's worried about, trusting these men in Washington to tell us the truth about the budget and how monies are going to be spent and what that means and all that kind of thing. Forgive me. I'm sorry. I departed into areas I should not go into. But, you know, there is. We are skittish about that. We are skittish about that. We want people to be honest in all things, but not being honest in money also opens to the door to whether or not there's covetousness that's possibly involved and other like or similar matters. Right.
Can I have help? Knowing that in great confidence and love, they're going to say, absolutely, thank you for letting me help.
Right.
There was no FEMA at that time. I think that's something in our culture that we've lost is, Paul is trying to point out, you're in abundance right now. Give knowing someday you will not give.
Right. Yeah, right. Right, right.
If we'll just take advantage of the opportunity, God will provide.
Yeah. That there will be an equality. That if brethren act as they should act, if they act out of love, if they trust in what God says, there can be an equality that brethren will enjoy. The same principle was found back in Acts 2 and Acts chapter 4. That there was not among those saints any that had a need, because others took care of it. Leslie, did you? And so much of chapter 9 is saying, look to God who has the ability to provide for you, to help you to be involved in every good work. Look to God. This is what is being said in those verses in verse 14 in chapter 8. A confidence that we can have that as God works in His people, He will use people. I think it was Dave Hamlet in his lesson two Wednesday nights ago that one of his points was that God works through His people to do His will. And this is another case of that. All right. So in chapter 9, the first five verses there is where he has discussed, have your gift ready so that that you won't be embarrassed. And he lays down this principle, the one that sows sparingly, verse 6, he'll reap sparingly, but the one that sows bountifully, he's going to be able to reap bountifully. What do you think it means when it says in verse 7, so let each one give as he purposes in his heart? How have we generally taken that passage, do you think? And have we used it correctly? What's been our general take on what that means, as one purposes in his heart? Okay, all right. That there's not really been any careful thought and planning in determining what one is going to give. And so what we look at this, we think, well, there needs to be, in our mind, in our heart, a decision made about what we can do, and then a following through with this. Is that a correct usage, do you think? Nobody wants to. Okay. Yeah, certainly as you look at all of the text there, as he purposes in his heart not grudgingly or of necessity. Brian?
I agree with Wade's point that God is about, God doesn't need my money or your money. And nothing that we ever give is going to impress in that sense, in the sense that the way humans evaluate it. So he's evaluating us in a way that no human can evaluate. He judges our heart. I think I often see this incorrectly used to where people, though, say that, see, this verse says that God's left is entirely up to me, so no one should ever preach or suggest or counsel me or offer any advice to try and modify my behavior anyway because God's left me free to do whatever I please in this matter.
Right.
And therefore, don't try to get me to do things better or differently.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And it is an individual matter, but it's not as though we haven't been given guidelines. Giving as we've been prospered is what he would say. Bob? Yes.
If something comes up and we know at that head, don't stop. What comes into our head? Are we giving grudgingly?
Yeah.
We give and still do grudgingly.
Right.
It must be grudgingly. Our attitude towards giving.
Yes.
What click of the number I have?
No, that's right.
But, remember the context of what he's been talking about here. He has set this up with, okay, y'all had made a promise. Y'all had made a commitment. And he's getting that down to the individual level now. It's not just, and I think Brian was hitting it on the head, the way we use this now is that, hey, there's no tithing, there's nothing there, there's no set amount I have to give, so whatever I decide to do, that's good enough. But he says, no, you have purposed something in your heart because of your love for the Lord and the love for the other Christians. You need to follow through on what you purpose in your heart.
Yes, yeah, yeah. All right, very good. I'm sorry, Wade, we didn't get... Thank you.